Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to New Books in Caribbean Studies. I'm Dan Levesey, one of the hosts of the channel. Joining me today is Marlene Dout, Associate Professor of English and Cultural Studies at Claremont Graduate University, and we're going to discuss her recent book, Tropics of Haiti, Race and the Literary History of the Haitian Revolution in the Atlantic World, 1789 to 1865. Marlene, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I wanted to kind of get started, as I usually do, talking about how you got into this project. And you write pretty candidly and openly about your own personal connections to Haiti, and I wonder if you could say a little bit about that and maybe how it led you to this consideration of the literary history of the Haitian Revolution.
Sure. So I first became interested in Haiti through kind of studying the literary circles in the early 19th century in New Orleans. And they kind of consistently led me back to Haiti. And my own family, as I write about in the book, is from Haiti. So I kind of had a natural interest in the topic for personal reasons and academic reasons. And I, of course, read my C.L.R. James, and I read many of the kind of standard books on the Haitian Revolution. And one thing that I noticed pretty early on was this idea of enlightenment literacy. And so the idea that Toussaint Louverture or other enslaved Africans read enlightenment philosophy, namely the Abbé Raynal's Histoire des Deux Indes, and that they became inspired to revolt and rebel against slavery. And so I thought, oh, I'll trace that idea in literature and just sort of see, you know, where it started and where it leads to. But one of the things that I found when I began to do archival research, first looking at kind of rare manuscripts in the Bibliothèque Nationale, was that that narrative was there, but it appeared to have become really popular later, that Enlightenment literacy narrative. There were other narratives that seemed to be competing with it and really kind of pushing it out. So if the Enlightenment literacy narrative was ultimately about freedom, from slavery, the Mulatto Vengeance narrative was really about racial motivations for the Haitian Revolution, and namely the idea that particularly people of quote-unquote mixed race or people who had some kind of hybrid status, a former slave who's now free, that they were motivated by revenge to rebel. And that was very interesting to me because it kept surfacing over and over again continuously, and was actually sort of much more resonant and popular than that enlightenment literacy narrative. And so that's really kind of what encouraged me to continue to find more of these narratives and to pursue this line of inquiry, not just in literature as such, but in literature in a more broad way, historiography and pamphlets and newspapers, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I really like that you have this great back and forth between a kind of historical perspective and the literary perspective and how they join up, and they're really integrated in such a great way. And I want to get to those issues around the Mulatto Vengeance narrative, but it might be worth considering just a little bit some of the scholarly conversations that you're considering, because I think that they help frame it pretty well. And so you're engaged in a couple of pretty important conversations at once. The first is sort of how scholars of the Haitian Revolution have addressed and to some degree still address the subject of racial dynamics in the country. And then second, how novelists and writers of fiction represented it in the early decades of Haiti's history. If you could just kind of give us a sense of what's happened until recently, at least, what was the scholarly narrative around race in the revolution?
I think until recently, the scholarly narrative has really been that there were three broadly construed groups of people involved in the Haitian Revolution. So that there were whites, in quotation marks, there were blacks who were, you know, nègres or slaves, and that there were mulattoes, often just interchangeably used with free people of color. And the interesting thing is that when you look at the literature of the Haitian Revolution, again, broadly conceived, you find that people aren't nearly as certain about what those terms meant as we appear to be today in our scholarship. And so one of the things I say is that race has not really been examined in the history of the Haitian Revolution because we've taken those very racial categories for granted. And so instead of interrogating what is the meaning of being quote-unquote nègre or mulâtre or gens de couleur, instead of really interrogating and pushing those terms and seeing not only where they came from, but really how they were used, how they changed, how a person could be called one in one context and called another in a different context, it seems to me sort of just assumed that that's the vocabulary that we have, and therefore that's the vocabulary that we should use. Whereas one of the things that I'm arguing is not that we should adopt a colorblind perspective to the Haitian Revolution and simply say, well, race didn't matter, is really much more what I'm saying, that there was a confusion about not only how much race or color did matter, but what race and color, what it was, and who was living in a raced body and who wasn't. And even though now we can say, of course, well, we all live in raced bodies, there's a way in which when you read the literature of the Haitian Revolution, that really there's a focus on quote-unquote mulattoes and Negroes and what they are doing to pursue these kind of vengeful ends because of their race. And so the white participants in the revolution appear a lot of times merely as defendants. They are not racially motivated. They are defending themselves from those who are. And so this is what I really wanted to kind of pursue as a line of inquiry and find out where did it come from and what are some of the constituent elements that made it so popular and why did it stay alive? And then related to that, why is this still a really resonant narrative in our scholarship today, even though we have so much work on critical race theory that would seem to, you know, encourage us to really dismantle and deconstruct those terms in the first place? Why has that not been done was one of the questions I was asking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and towards the end, I want to come back to that issue of why that's still such a prominent part of the discussion around the Haitian Revolution, because I think that certainly seems to be the case in the way a lot of people write about it. But let's kind of go into the major subjects that you tackle here, particularly in terms of the tropes that you find in the discussions, both kind of on the political side of reactions to the Haitian Revolution, and then ongoing into the literary representations throughout the late 18th and the early 19th century. And one of the things, I was really amazed at the sheer number of pamphlets and plays and novels that come out of that. There's well over 100, and so there's just really, it seems to be a fertile ground for people to want to consider these issues. And you dissect a number of major themes, and the first one is this idea of the monstrous hybrid or the general idea of monstrous hybridity. If you could just maybe spend a few minutes explaining what that is and then how it applies to Haiti and even beyond just the idea of race mixing, how it gets kind of to become this really important trope about people's understanding of that nation.
Yeah, I mean, in a certain sense, monstrous hybridity could be considered the most important of the tropes in the sense that it kind of shapes all of the other tropes. And by that, I mean that monstrous hybridity is much less about actual status of being a person of mixed race and more about framing. So using a language that was developed in what I call pseudoscientific debates about race in the early modern world and using that language to describe their contemporaries, so contemporaries of the Haitian Revolution. And what emerges is a sense of incongruity, a sense of vengeance, a sense of a really malicious personality elements clashing with other personality elements that usually came from either pure whiteness or pure blackness, but that when merged together created this sort of very vengeful very irate behavior. And it's interesting because, as you were sort of alluding to there, eventually this discourse that came out of, you know, what happens when whites and blacks, quote unquote, procreate together, became attached to people who would not ordinarily be considered hybrid in some way. For example, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, I'd say, is, you know, probably one of the most, you know, immediate people who comes to mind when I think of monstrous hybridity that, as it was written about in this discourse. He's the homme tigre, a tiger man. He he's barely human, and he's almost cannibalistic in these narratives. And so in that sense, it actually helps to shape the other tropes, because we have to depend first on something, and that something becomes black savagery, which ends up conjoining together with white civilization. And it is those sort of stereotypes merging together that bring us the tropology that allows for vengeance to really kind of shine through in a lot of these narratives. Vengeance particularly attached to people who could not be described as fully European or fully African, either because of their quote-unquote blood or because of their upbringing. So Toussaint Louverture is another person who gets really codified, both in the past and in the present, actually, in terms of his status as being a hybrid. And, of course, in the 18th and 19th century, this is much more monstrous, maybe, than it would seem in contemporary discourse, where sometimes hybridity is celebrated.
And is that a particularly new, not invention, but a kind of a emerging trope that is somewhat unique to Haiti? Does it draw on some maybe European or even African precedents? I mean, you're largely dealing with a lot of authors who come from a European background. But is that something that kind of develops in a unique fashion in Haiti?
I would say, you know, so one of the things I say is that, you know, monstrous hybridity wasn't created by the discourse about the Haitian Revolution. So it wasn't created by authors like Moreau de Saint-Méry. Really, they kind of developed the trope and helped to attach it to the Haitian Revolution, where it gained its present resonance. And so they made it popular. So travel writers wrote about monstrous hybridity in Africa, for example, Edward Long, others. They wrote about what happened when quote-unquote white civilization met Negro savagery or African savagery. They wrote about what they thought literally happened when people would racially mix, so to speak. And when that language, people like Labat and Nicholson and all these kind of early modern travel writers to the French Caribbean in particular, when that language became co-opted to discuss the Haitian Revolution, it really turned into a way to provide blame and also really to absolve the French colonists for any kind of cruelties that were performed under slavery, which was really to say that, you see, we had to treat them so severely because look what happens when you let up for a moment. And it became a way to blame the free people of color for that it was their desire to have too much. It was them being ungrateful. And this is people like Malouet and others that their desire for freedom was really leading the slaves, the enslaved Africans, to want to pursue freedom also. And so it becomes attached to the Haitian Revolution, but it doesn't necessarily begin there, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this might be a good spot to talk about the second major trope, not to kind of move on from that, because I think that they're all sort of interlinked, but the second major trope you talk about is this idea of mulatto or mulatto vengeance, which is pretty recurrent throughout the whole period of the Haitian Revolution and on into the 19th century. And there's a sort of famous case of a man named Vincent Auger who comes back from France to Saint-Domingue and has this coup. And you sort of talk about how there's a lot of blame put onto him. And it's not necessarily the beginning of this idea of mulatto vengeance, but that this becomes this very prominent strain in considerations of why this revolution occurs. And so there's a lot to kind of parse out of this idea of mulatto vengeance. And so what is sort of at the heart of this idea that people of mixed ancestry are just inherently looking out for revenge and sort of almost this, well, not almost, but a patricidal rage against their parents?
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that really struck me when I first began to see the pattern of sort of mulatto vengeance up against Enlightenment literacy, was all of the patricide. And so the more I began to kind of study how revolutions are written about, I thought, okay, well, parasitical narratives become a part of the American Revolution and the French Revolution. But it didn't seem to be quite as literal. It seemed very metaphorical, like, oh, we're overthrowing England, or we need to get rid of the king and his patriarchal authority. But in the Haitian Revolution, people really seem to actually be suggesting, if not outright arguing, that children were killing their parents and vice versa, and that there was all kinds of infanticide, and there was matricide, and all of these things that really were unthinkable to people. So we talk about the Haitian Revolution as being unthinkable, but I think what was very unthinkable to people was that parents and children would not even just be politically on opposite sides, but wouldn't necessarily know that there was kind of all of this duplicity involved, that you wouldn't necessarily be able to know, and that you might accidentally kill your own parent, which is, you know, what one character in Victor Hugo's Bouguer Chagall sort of argues and remonstrates against. Like, make sure you just, if you're going to do it, don't do it yourself. And when I kept seeing that this was coming up over and over again, I wanted to kind of pursue it and find out, you know, what was it that made the Haitian Revolution appear to actually pit people living in the same house against one another? And I think part of it has to do with, you know, there were, we tend to think, at least in terms of sort of questions that I usually get asked, people say, but it seems like there was a lot of mulatto exceptionalism going around. So in African-American discourse, the trope of the tragic mulatta, for example, is sort of like this light-skinned woman who is supposedly so beautiful that her life is in peril because, you know, white slaveholders can't control their sexual desires for her. And she's usually extremely intelligent and, you know, all of these things that go along with this kind of tropology. But what we find in the Haitian Revolution is much more ambivalence about these people who are of mixed race, that they are not enchanting figures a lot of times. They are figures of destruction. And I think that it's, of course, a way to make a clearer separation between whiteness and blackness, to suggest that it is so dangerous to racially mix that you could be creating a family member, a child, who might one day come and kill you in your sleep. And I think that that has to have, at an affective level, affected people's consciousness of the revolution, their ability to kind of go about their daily lives, and their treatment of their own slaves. When I really sort of get down to think about it, that if you were living with that belief in your mind, you know, how would that make you behave? And so I think it was a way, it was a measure of control. It was a way to put deeper controls onto colonial society and try to harness the threat of the Haitian Revolution, the threat of slave rebellion, and the threat that the people in the colony who were free in general would try to get independence from France.
Is it also part of the, maybe just a general confusion that certain authors have around what it is to be of mixed ancestry? And, you know, Edward Long very famously thinks that people of mixed descent are sterile, yeah. Right? That they're essentially mules, and so they can't reproduce. And I think there's a similar discourse in the French Atlantic as well. So is part of this maybe just a general uncertainty about what is the place of these individuals? What is their biology even? Are they a threat to families? What do you think are some of the central problems that they pose beyond just, well, they're not black, they're not white in their minds? What are some of the other problems that people of mixed descent pose?
I think they posed serious questions about freedom, right? Can you hold other human beings in bondage, right? Because, so one of the things that I think is that, you know, the Edward Longs and the Moreau de Saint-Méry's, people who spent a lot of time in the colonies, that they really knew that what they were writing was not true. And so one of the things I trace for Moreau de Saint-Méry is all of those little moments of ambivalence in which he says, basically, he gives a caveat, like, you really shouldn't take this too seriously. So contrary to Edward Long, Moreau de Saint-Méry thinks that that after the first instance of, you know, racial mixing, miscegenation, to use an ahistorical term for his time period, but that after that first instance, which would result in a kind of regeneration, that degeneration would occur. So the closer and closer that a person of African descent came to looking like a European, or to the farther away they got from that quote unquote bloodline, that the more kind of sterile the person would get, the more sallow and weak the person would get. And I think to myself, he being a father of at least one child of mixed race and then grandchildren of mixed race has to know that this narrative, that this is not true, that this is not correct. So I ask then, well, what is it serving? Well, it's serving one of his broader purposes, which is to discourage racial mixing, because his pamphlets that he was publishing, particularly in the 1780s and the 1790s, were all about the threat that people of mixed race and really free people of color posed in particular. And so you can really see there's a fear, in as much as he is involved with people of color sexually and it living with a free woman of color and having a child with her and then raising that child to be white with his new wife, even with all of that, there is still a distinct fear, there is an ambivalence, and there is also a desire to control the colony. There's to control the, which is precisely what we learn, I think, by reading the works of someone like Doris Garraway in The Libertine Colony and John Garrigus in Before Haiti, which is really how much people wanted to control the way that the population would grow in Saint-Domingue. But one of the things that I was really interested in was the way that those controls would make people feel, the way that they would make someone like Mohou de Saint-Méry feel, but also perhaps more importantly, the way they made enslaved Africans, particularly enslaved African women, feel, and free women of color, to know that they are being constantly stereotyped in this way, and the acute ways in which these women were written about as having some sense that those stereotypes and that tropology was being attached to them, and these women wanting to or attempting to combat it, knowing how dangerous it was, what it meant for them, that it was not just, oh, people will think of you in a certain way, but that it would have life or death repercussions.
Mm-hmm. That's actually a great segue into one of the later sections, which is talking about the idea of the female temptress. And I really liked the way you kind of discussed it's important to bring women back into discussions around revolution and especially enslaved revolution. And I think there's been some slow work starting to be put forward recently on that question. How does this idea of the temptress of color, which, you know, there's a lot of colonial discourses around women as temptresses, but how does it fit into the particular narrative that you're finding in the Haitian Revolution? Because I think it is somewhat unique to Haiti.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right that, I mean, even that sort of temptress narrative is attached to the tragic mulatta. I mean, she's so beautiful that she tempts her looks alone, supposedly tempts these enslavers to want to come and rape her, essentially, right? Or seduce her in some way. But one of the things I noticed in reading the literature of the Haitian Revolution was that if you look at the tropical temptress through the eyes of these largely male writers, and you sort of believe in their accounts, then yes, you get this idea of the tropical temptress. And even if you say it's a stereotype and all of that, that this is what you are sort of, this is the representation you have. But one of the things I suggest is that if you look at it from the opposite perspective, okay, you're talking about a woman of color who poisons her master. Well, of course, the columnist writing about this thinks that this is a terrible thing and writes about the treachery of this woman. But from the other perspective, I say this is a woman being defiant. This is a woman rebelling against authority. And that rebellion against authority does not always operate in ways that would necessarily jive with scholars' current perceptions of the Haitian Revolution. For example, I talk about this resonant narrative of Jean-Jacques Dessalines' wife, Marie-Claire Heureuse, and how she supposedly, in all these narratives, was saving white colonists, especially women and children, from the mandates of her husband to either exterminate or expel them from the island. And is that betrayal, or is this some kind of, you know, revolutionary behavior? And depending upon the narrative in which you find this account, she's this benevolent woman brought to the island by God to perform this kind of sanctimonious office, or is she betraying her husband? And when I see that she is considered a hero in Haiti today, that there's La Maison de Marie-Claire Heureuse in Haiti to this day, I say that, you know, perhaps we need to change the way that we think about what is heroic during the Haitian Revolution, and particularly when it comes to women. And so there are writings about Cécile Fatima and a few other women revolutionaries who engaged in sort of armed combat. But I think that we've tended to shy away from the behaviors that are not clear to us, what sort of ideology the person engaging the behavior was, you know, shared. So was Marie-Claire Heureuse, was she saving whites because she thought that Dessalines was wrong? Is it some sort of sympathetic identification? What were her motives? And that's what I mean when I say I'm much more interested in kind of thinking about how people who were usually left out of the narrative, how did they feel? So not simply what they did and how we can read that, but how can we access their, how they felt about it, how it affected them, how a person could be ideologically in favor of the revolution but not want to see people they consider to be innocent murdered. And I think that these are questions we must continue to answer, especially in, you know, sort of our own political climate where people kind of throw the word, I think, revolutionary and revolution and out about without really kind of interrogating, well, what does that mean to have a revolution? It's really a bloody, messy affair. And a lot of the actors of the revolution, including Toussaint Louverture, in the way that he's written about, understood this, and they really had a hard time in thinking about a revolution that involved indiscriminate violence. And I think we should all have a hard time with indiscriminate violence. So I think those are important people to continue to study and try to access their motives and feelings and not just, you know, how we can look at their behaviors and then sort of interpret that.
Mm-hmm. I hate to maybe go back because you've discussed it a little bit, but maybe if you could talk about kind of how those links around the discourse around the temptress and how that doesn't necessarily sync up well with the women themselves, but then also how this idea of the tragic mulatta kind of figures into that and how those two interact, and this idea of giving some aspect of maybe strange agency to women, but at the same time taking it away with this idea of individuals who are bound to lead to disaster or self-harm or all sorts of things of tragedy.
Yeah, and I mean, the tragic mulatta is sort of, so, you know, one of the things I say is that there were at certain points in writing this book, it was really difficult to read all of these narratives over and over again. And so, you know, I apologize for continuing to bring up the issue of sexual violence, but it's such a feature of these narratives, and the tragic mulatta really is a figure who cannot be understood without thinking about sexual violence, sexual assault, and rape, because this determines most of the time how she came into being, and also the threat that she constantly feels. So a lot of the colonists write about the threat that these women would pose. Also, someone like Leonora Sanse writes about the threat that these women of mixed race would pose to white families. But, I mean, are we really thinking about the sort of fear, the threat that these women felt? And, you know, Sarah Johnson's book, The Fear of French Negroes, is really sort of helpful in that regard, in terms of she's thinking about what did enslaved Africans feel? What kind of fear did they feel, right? And so I simply say, even to the free woman of color, what was her daily sort of threat level? You know, what was she experiencing, and how is her behavior being read? And in terms of, not in terms of self-defense, a lot of times, but really kind of like self-immolation. But this suicide that gets attached to tragic mulattas is a suicide that's better than life. And so this is one of the reasons why I think, you know, is the tragic mulatta that tragic? When we read along the grain of the narrative, sure. But when we think about what kind of life is she escaping, then the other face of that is a face of rebellion and is a face of resistance. And that was really, you know, sort of what I'm interested in is not continuing to kind of pursue, you know, because there's a way in which you could trace the tragic mulatta throughout the literature of the Haitian Revolution and show all the ways in which it neatly fits into that narrative. But I'm also interested in how we can sort of think beyond that narrative to get to access other feelings, other experiences, other affective responses that are not necessarily served by thinking about the tragic mulatta as a stable figure that always appears in the same way, in the same formula, that maybe there are different formulas, and maybe that those different formulations have something to tell us, not only about representation, but really about what the meaning of race was to people who were writing about it and people who were living it, people who were living in those raced bodies.
And do you think ultimately that aspect or the thought of the trash mulatta and the very real sexual violence that was going on, is that in some ways maybe one of the essential hearts of this narrative around vengeance, and is that why perhaps there's this skewed sense about what the motivations of mixed race people are because of sort of this inherent understanding of the origins of this community?
I think so, because, you know, so one of the things that really struck me about Victor Séjour's narrative in Le Mulâtre was how all this entire black family, this entire family of people of color, that it was the predominance of sexual assault. This entire family came to be because of sexual assault, and this entire family was dismantled because of sexual assault, right? And what would that generate from a generational standpoint? So when In the Souls of Black Folk, W.E.B. Du Bois says that it was an evil omen to see his child, who had two black parents, two parents of color, born with, you know, these kind of blue specks in his eyes and golden hair, because to Du Bois, that called forth the history of rape and sexual violence against women of color during slavery. And he knew that the only way for those genetic traits to be present in his child was for there to have been some kind of interracial mixing. And there's a sense in which, you know, all the sexual relationships on a plantation have to be viewed in the realm of sexual assault, because what does consent mean in those circumstances? And this is precisely the kind of conversation that is really coming forward in the public eye around Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson. And, you know, people want to believe this is a love affair, but what does love look like between an enslaved person and a master? I mean, it can only be a perverse love, if love exists at all, in that if that is even a proper word that one could use, it could only be perverse. It could only be malicious. And I think that this is one of the real tragedies of the tragic mulatto and the tragic mulatta, is that this person is almost always figured to be either in fact or sort of metaphorically the result of a violent sexual relationship. And what is that? What is the legacy? And so that's why I also really wanted to look at Aimeric Berger's Stella, that first Haitian novel, because we really see what unfolds when you build a family based on such violence, and the violence that you can sort of pass down through your children, just like you pass down those genetic traits, which is also a feature of much later sort of allusions to the Haitian Revolution, William Faulkner's Absalom, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these are all such great points. And you know, for the listeners, it's such a rich book, and I'm not doing justice to all the detailed analysis of the literally like dozens and dozens of pamphlets and novels. So I apologize for just kind of speeding through. But I want to get at sort of the last section of the book, which is really important, and I think figures into the whole scope of how many people have viewed the revolution kind of since its founding, or not since its founding, but since the 19th century, I should say. And that is this idea of the colored historian, or the mulatto legend of history. And what you're grappling with the way that scholars treat 19th century portrayals of the Haitian Revolution. And so could you just kind of sketch out what you mean by the colored historian or the mulatto legend of history, and then we can kind of talk about its influence?
Sure. So, you know, when I first began to study the Haitian Revolution, of course, one of the first, or Haitian literature, I should say, one of the first books that I knew I needed to read was David Nichols' From Dessalines to Duvalier. And I was really struck by, you know, his observations of the way in which 19th century Haitian, quote unquote, racial or color politics have affected what was, in his day, in the 1970s, present day contemporary Haitian society. But there's a chapter that sort of always unsettled me. And it was the chapter on the mulatto legend of history. And really the argument there is that the idea that you could kind of predict or determine for the most part, because he has a lot of caveats in there, for the most part, you could predict or determine the narrative that would emerge from a historian's writing, a Haitian historian's writing, based on their skin color. And so I tried to think about how could we make this argument about any other place in the world? Like, could we make this argument about the United States? Like, well, white historians almost always say this. Black historians almost always say that. And when, you know, people would say, but it's Haiti, it's not the U.S. And that felt too much like Haitian exceptionalism to me. So I decided that even though I'm going to have to read all these tomes from Thomas Mathieu and Beaubrun Ardouin and Joseph Serremy, these historians who are really prolific, that in order to really see if, you know, is there any teeth to this argument, that we really need to actually look through the representation, read those works, not just as sources, and great sources they are, but read them as narrative, as literature, as a part of the literary history of Haiti and of the Haitian Revolution, so therefore of the Atlantic world. And what I found was particularly in Serremy's case, that that there was an idea that because he was a quote-unquote mulatto, a free person of a descendant of the free people of color, I should say, that he was going to put forth a certain narrative. And the narrative that I find in his works is ambivalence. One thing he's sure about is that one thing that Serremy is sure about is that race didn't determine who would be loyal to whom during the Haitian Revolution. And he really wants us to know that. And I think this has unsettled a lot of historians, and I think that is why he became the focus of a lot of these narratives about the mulatto legend of history. And the reason I call it the colored historian is because this is a sort of a lithograph that preceded one of William Wells Brown's works, and he was called the colored historian. But I just thought that it was so apt, right? So the historian is of color. This is posing a problem for many 19th century historians like John Beard and James Redpath, who are really adamant that this color is going to color the person's interpretation of history, but without sort of any kind of reflexivity that their own color could then be coloring or shaping their interpretation of Haitian history. And so, again, just sort of trying to get at why it is important for someone to present Haitian history in this way. And so I always say that, you know, it's undeniable to look at Haitian society today and, of course, in Nichols' day and to say there's no quote-unquote racial prejudices or color prejudices. But it seems to me that he used a model, he worked backwards, perhaps, went from contemporary society and then used that to help him explain 19th century Haitian society. And I don't think we were quite there yet. I think that those color prejudices were very performative. We can see them ardently sort of being worked at by people like Gobineau and Alexandre Bonneau, who were adamant, and Thomas Carlyle even, who were adamant that blacks and mulattoes could never live together in peace, that they must naturally hate one another. And so that's one of the things that I'm really sort of contesting in the book is, why should we think that that enmity is natural? Why would that enmity be natural? And the only thing that I can think of is that these white British and European and French historians of the period, their enmity felt natural to them, their enmity toward people of color, and they assumed that the closer someone was to whiteness, to being like them, that person would share the same ideas about race. What they didn't understand about Haitians was that Joseph Serremy considered himself African and considered himself black. And so sometimes he wrote about himself and using the term gens de couleur. Sometimes he said he had a brown face. Another time he said he had a front nègre, a negro kind of face or forehead, literally. But that's the part I think that the 19th century historians missed, is that the mulattoes didn't consider themselves to be white. They pretty much understood that this quote-unquote taint of the tar brush, to quote one author, was really going to shape how people viewed them from the standpoint of color and from the standpoint of race. So that's really kind of what I wanted to explore, was this shift in the way that 19th century historians wrote about and thought about race, and how it led us to this present moment of believing believing in the idea that a person's skin color really did was the determining factor that made them write about Haitian history in a certain manner.
Well, and you really showed that when you kind of analyze the entirety of these quote unquote colored historians' works, it's really tough to assign any kind of racial identity to them, or that they are trying to drive racial wedges in the history of Haiti. Do you think that it's because the authors that are interpreting them, not just in the 19th century, but even in the 20th century, are coming at it from a place of a kind of a fear about the America's enslaved population and what that's going to do? Or is it an attempt to try to offer an explanation as to why they believe Haiti is a failed state? What do you think is sort of the reflective? I mean, I know I'm kind of asking you to go from the perspective of the outsiders, which is not the focus of this book, but why do you think that takes on such urgency? Is it because this idea of a failed state? Is it because of non-Haitians' concerns about their own populations of color?
Yeah, and so in part four of the book, where the three chapters are that deal with the colored historian, so one of the things I say is that I used James Redpath and John Beard and Saint-Rémy and Victor Chercher to a certain extent, precisely because there isn't an easy answer to figure out, why. Whereas with someone like Alexandre Bonneau, or certainly Gobineau, or even Carlyle, that there are distinct reasons, or Josiah Nott, right? There are distinct reasons that these pro-slavery propagandists want to put forward this idea of Haiti, of blacks and mulattoes in distinct enmity with one another forever, naturally, and the vengeance that they both feel supposedly towards whites, right? That this is serving a narrative of anti-miscegenation. We must keep an enslaved population in check. We must make sure that we don't have too many emancipated or free people of color hanging around. It's really clear in those narratives. But the people that I'm really looking at in depth in part four are abolitionists for the most part. They're anti-slavery activists. They're people who are dismantling race. They call themselves friends to Haiti, friends to the Negroes, and yet how is it that, and I quote Anne Laura Stoller, that racism is serving so many different ends at the same time? And that is a piece that is really difficult to know. Is it because they were copying from prior authors whose works were much more adamantly, sort of ideological in favor of slavery, in favor of colonialism? Is that the reason why? I mean, that certainly seems to be part of the issue with someone like William Wells Brown's works, because I was so surprised to see him copy the passages from Beard that were really kind of malicious passages about people of color. And the confusion, you can really see the confused elements in his work when in one passage he sort of demonizes mulattoes, quote unquote, and in another passage he sort of says that they were naturally superior and they should have been the people to lead enslaved Africans to freedom. And so you sort of ask yourself, well which is it? Are they naturally malicious and they hate, all people who are, quote, who are not of mixed race? Or are they the ones who were of superior talents, I believe is the exact phrase, and should have led enslaved Africans to freedom? And how he gets there is copying certain elements from Beard, who had copied from people like Chercher and even Saint-Rémy. So I think that's one answer, is that in the works that are more ambivalent, confused ideas of race appear, is that there was a lot of copying going on, there was a lot of influence going on. But I think the other thing is that people generally seem to have been, if the literature of the Haitian Revolution is any indication, generally seem to have been pretty wary of quote-unquote miscegenation. And I think it occasioned all kinds of questions for them about family inheritance, about national identity, so questions beyond racial identity, that it really seemed to unsettle them on multiple levels, because we find so much ambivalence about, well, will these people be able to say they're part of the family and come and, have a lawsuit against us and take our property? And I mean, there were really practical concerns that people who are writing about the Haitian Revolution, narrating it, even in fictional form, seem to suggest were on the minds of people. So not just about keeping bloodlines pure, although that was important to them as well, but also like what practically will happen if racial mixing continues to be a feature of this colony and of life in a colony where there's slavery, or in a land such as the United States where there's, domestic slavery.
Mm-hmm. Well, not to kind of cut this short, but I just wonder, because you touch on it very briefly at the end, but to what degree are these narratives still kind of in play, either in Haiti itself or just in the language that people use when they're talking about Haiti? You have this very evocative passage at the very end, you know, addressing sort of the way people respond to the earthquake in 2010 and how in some ways these ideas haven't quite died out. So what do you see as the legacy of this, and how does it maybe fit into a major narrative you talk about, which is Haitian exceptionalism?
Yes, I mean, that was one of the striking things. I always say, you know, I had to keep the introduction short because it was almost like you can't go on anymore. Because when I found the narratives in the 20th century and that they were still continuing, it was like, it's too much, right? Because, you know, sort of if you could just leave it in the past and show that the way forward was better somehow or even remarkably different. But what I found was that especially monstrous hybridity just prevails in our contemporary media, that Haiti is a place where revenge is on the mind of contemporary citizens as well as politicians, that Haitians are in some way to blame for their current situation. Everyday Haitians, I don't mean the Haitian government, I mean ordinary Haitians, that there's like a legacy of the Haitian Revolution that lives on through them. And a legacy of the Haitian Revolution that continues to call forth ideas about vengeance. So, of course, I talk about Pat Robertson's infamous comments and David Brooks' infamous comments in the wake of the earthquake. And that when I found that, you know, when Haiti had another earthquake in the 19th century that struck Cap-Haïtien, that there were still these, you know, narratives of blame. But later in the 19th century, Spencer St. John continued to call forth mulatto vengeance and monstrous hybridity, and also to continue to blame the Haitian people for various natural disasters that had struck the island of Hispaniola and had particularly affected the part that is Haiti. And so I do continue to find those narratives pretty much, you know, whenever Haiti is evoked as, you know, not being important or only being important because of the threat. And so when Aristide, for example, there was a coup d'etat in 2004, and this CNN broadcast said, you know, Haiti is not really strategically important, but it is close by. And so Haiti is still a threat. And why is that? You know, an article in the Miami Herald, you know, a land where justice can mean revenge, or they have a French patois, a mix of languages, like an imperfect understanding even of what Haitian Creole is, that it must be part of the problem. And I think there's a really poignant scene in Jonathan Demme's The Agronomist about the radio personality Jean-Dominique, where the filmmaker says, you know, here are the ambassadors basically to Haiti from the United States and various different officials, and they are listening to Aristide speaking Creole, and they are disapproving of the fact that he is speaking in Creole, that he's inciting them to rebellion, that this is a language of rebellion. And this is a language that is a Creole. It's a mix. And so it kind of becomes this really apt metaphor that just even using that language means that you are, quote unquote, hybrid people, sort of somehow destined for or more open to revenge in your society as being sort of the dominant mode of political organization and even just personality of politicians in general.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's such a great examination of a really long history of Haiti and the debates both past and present around how people discuss it and how the Haitians themselves feel in opposing ways. Just before we leave, I wonder if you could talk about what you're working on next and if you're kind of jumping onto a new territory or building off of this study.
Yeah, so I'm both jumping into new territory and building, I would say. So the sort of most immediate project that comes to mind is the Anthology of Haitian Revolutionary Fictions, which is based on the website that I created for Tropics of Haiti in order to provide a bibliography that could be accessible to everyone, whether or not they have the book or have access to the book, of some of the distinctly fictional works of the Haitian Revolution. Because it seemed to me that a lot of the historical works might be more well-known, aside from the pamphlets and newspaper articles, but that the fictional works, there are many more than just the really famous works like by Lamartine or Hugo or Bergeau or Flaubert, that there were many more. And so that will be both a kind of combination of a website and a printed anthology with excerpts and translation that people can use hopefully in the classroom or use to kind of think about the role of fiction in shaping our understanding of the Haitian Revolution. And then I'm continuing to work on this sort of idea that I call the Haitian Atlantic, which is really an intellectual history of Haiti from the 19th century to the early 20th century, and its sort of resonance in the Atlantic world, the readership of Haitian authors from the U.S. and France and Britain and in Africa and in South America, and you know, where did their works travel to, sort of tracing the resonance of Haitian thought around, because I see so many you know, parallels between, for example, someone like Baron de Vaté and Aimé Césaire and François Fanon and Jean-Paul Sartre. And so I'm just interested in sort of tracing influence that is either sort of organic or that is, in fact, we know that Césaire, for example, read Vaté. So just sort of looking at that. And again, I sort of call that sphere of influence the Haitian Atlantic.
Well, sounds like you're really resting on your laurels then. No, that sounds great. I'm looking forward to seeing all that. So, well, thanks so much for joining me. I really appreciate you talking to me, and I really enjoyed the book quite a bit.
Thank you so much for having me, and I really enjoyed talking to you today.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.